From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to Here and Now. We're following today's historic meeting between the leaders of North and South Korea, which came at the end of a busy week of diplomacy. At the White House today, President Trump meets German Chancellor Angela Merkel. This is just a one-day get-together, and it stands in stark contrast to the state dinner and address to Congress during the three-day visit by French President Emmanuel Macron earlier this week. Our political roundtable is coming right up, but first let's bring in Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson, NPR's Berlin correspondent. She joins us from the German capital. Soraya, thanks for being here.
Oh, you're welcome.
Germany is Europe's largest economy, a key U.S. ally. Any frustration in Berlin that Merkel is not getting anything close to the Macron treatment in Washington?
Well, it's interesting because I don't think she'd be very comfortable with that. I mean, she's sort of a no-nonsense, get-to-the-facts kind of person, and it's not like she and Mr. Trump have had any kind of close relationship. I mean, they didn't talk for about 5 months until last month when she was just reelected to her newest term. So I don't think she's really looking for that. But she is in America trying to do damage control because right now, Mr. Trump doesn't really see Germany as a reliable partner.
Damage control. And Germany, you know, of course, is the economic powerhouse of Europe and diplomatic powerhouse as well. And U.S. tariffs on steel and aluminum imports are scheduled to take effect May 1st. Germany isn't happy about that. Talk to us about Merkel's case to the president on trade and tariffs. Will the EU get another exemption or not?
Well, she certainly is going to push for it. I mean, it's very important, and it would obviously hurt Germany and the rest of Europe if these tariffs were imposed. What she's probably going to talk about is that it's not, I mean, you can't really nitpick. I mean, that this America First approach isn't going to work. She's not going to give in on changing individual tariffs or doing certain things. But what she wants to point out to Mr. Trump is that Germany actually has double the investments in America when you compare it to America in Germany. The fact that Germany can't really help all the factors that lead to a trade surplus, that Germany and Europe are very much open to renegotiating a trade deal. In fact, that's what they want. And so she's going to try and encourage Mr. Trump to try and look at this a little more broadly rather than specifically picking nits, if you will, or saying, okay, we're going to do this to steel, or you need to do this about cars, and not really take into account the bigger picture. So this is why I think senior German officials are not really counting on her necessarily being able to convince Mr. Trump that these tariffs should not be imposed on May 1.
Soraya, do you think the fact that Merkel doesn't seem to have anything like a close personal, connection with the president, will it harm her efforts when it comes to trade, when it comes to the Iran deal?
Well, it's difficult to really understand what motivates the American president. And so it's unclear what is the better approach. She's not really going to change who she is, and she does have to answer to the German populace as well as to her coalition government. For example, on issues like NATO, on spending, defense spending, she can't really just go in and say, okay, we're going to do the 2% that Mr. Trump wants, to offer that carrot because there is opposition to it here. So she will just do what she's always done, which is be very factual and analytical. I mean, she is a scientist by training, and hope that something that she says will connect with the president and so that the relationship will improve.
NPR's Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson in Berlin. Soraya, thank you.
You're welcome, Eric.
And so as we just heard, before Merkel, there was Macron, a bromance. And this week also saw the confirmation of Mike Pompeo as Secretary of State. He's already in Brussels. And this morning at a White House event, the president took some credit for the thaw in relations between North and South Korea and possible denuclearization there.
When I began, people were saying that was an impossibility. They said there were two alternatives. Let them have what they have or go to war. And now we have a much better alternative than anybody thought even possible.
But it was also a week where Dr. Ronny Jackson, Trump's nominee to lead the Veterans Affairs Department, withdrew as misconduct allegations surfaced. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt was grilled by Congress for 6 hours about ethical lapses. And President Trump gave a meandering Fox News interview that at the very least caused him some more legal problems. Let's bring in Beth Fooey, senior politics editor for NBC and MSNBC. And welcome, Beth.
Thanks for having me.
So can Trump, claim some credit for Korea and the thaw that's going on there?
Well, he's doing it, so I guess he can do it. And look, if this proves to be fruitful and something that a lot of foreign policy experts would have called impossible not long ago, the reunification of the peninsula and the denuclearization of North Korea, he will certainly have played a role in that. He's engaged personally, which American presidents typically have not done at the level that Trump is doing right now. Hmm. I mean, yes, he's called Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader, little rocket man, but also earlier this week, he referred to him as honorable, not a term that is often used for him, certainly by the Western powers. I mean, it wasn't long ago, as you guys recall, that President George W. Bush referred to North Korea as part of the axis of evil. Hmm. So the fact that we have a president, a Republican president, reaching out in this way, he said he would meet with Kim Jong-un, but they are supposedly going to have a summit sometime soon. The fact that he sent his now Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, then the CIA director, over, who then met personally with Kim Jong-un as well, is showing a level of diplomatic engagement that we have not really seen in the past. But there's a lot of details that still need to be worked out, of course.
Sure. And people are pointing to other times in history, to Reagan, you know, bringing down the wall in the Soviet Union. But then they also are reminded that critics of that thinking say that actually the Soviet Union was collapsing on its own accord, and our intelligence didn't even know that. Today, China says that Chinese scientists claim an important North Korean nuclear testing site was partially destroyed in a recent earthquake. It's thought that might be the reason why Kim Jong-un declared that he was suspending missile testing. So it could be that the North is falling on its own. But, you know, many of his supporters are pointing to the president's language and saying this is what made it work. Let's listen to White House advisor Kellyanne Conway this morning on Fox News.
I think many elements of the swamp are still not accustomed to Trump-Pence pace. They operate on swamp speed. But when you see actions like this around the globe, you recognize the difference it makes to have a non-politician who's been thinking about these issues for many years in a very different way.
Oh, and so there you have it. I mean, we just want to lay out that there are those who are supporting. We're just going to have to see how this plays out, Beth Fooey, as you said. But let's move to the Russia investigation, because this morning the House Intelligence Committee ended its investigation of Russian election interference. They released a highly redacted 200-plus page report that Democrats on the committee refused to endorse. It found no Trump campaign collusion with Russians. It faulted both the Trump and Clinton campaigns for poor judgment and ill-considered actions on Russia. Where are we on the Russia investigation the end of this week?
Well, we are at a place where we've been for a long time, which is that ultimately the special counsel is going to render a judgment, a report, an assessment of what went on, and that is going to be the ultimate arbiter of what may or may not have occurred. This House Intelligence Committee report was discredited long before it was even fully released. The House Republicans, as you guys know, released sort of a partial version of this a couple of months ago, and this is the full version. And even back then, Democrats were crying foul that it was incomplete, that lots of witnesses that should have been brought in for interviews were not, that the House Republicans were more concerned about protecting the president than really getting to the bottom of what happened. So look, we're in such a politically polarized moment in our history that almost nothing about the Russia investigation has been done without the taint of partisanship. That's why the special counsel was brought in. The idea was, anyway, that he's sort of a neutral outside arbiter, free of politics, who can just look at the facts and explain to us what happened. Of course, that too is may not be the case, because the president and many of his allies have gone on the warpath against the special counsel, the FBI, the Justice Department. So when the special counsel's report comes out, it too will be challenged. But the House Intelligence Committee certainly is not going to be the final assessment. The Senate Intelligence Committee is going to produce a report as well. And as I said initially, the special counsel, who's got incredible resources at his command and has been studying this now for some year and a half almost, with some of the best investigators in Washington, will come up with a judgment that will be the one that is to be rendered to history.
Beth, I want to follow up briefly on that. I mean, the report does confirm this sustained Russian policy to try to interfere in U.S. politics. I mean, can't Democrats and Republicans at least agree on that?
Well, as we've seen, President Trump will barely even acknowledge that. I mean, he'll say it looks like the Russians interfered, but then he'll say it could have been China. It could have been someone else. You know, the famous 400-pound guy on the bed. Yeah. He's never fully embraced the notion that Russia did this so systematically and aggressively. Others in his administration have, but he does not. And until and unless the president does that, he is not sending the firm message that this was done, that it is a problem that remains and that a problem going forward unless there's an aggressive action to stop it.
Beth, we only have a minute left. I have to ask you, we had the president's nominee for the VA, Ronny Jackson, withdraw his name. We had Scott Pruitt be grilled. And in the middle of this, I remember looking over and Eric said, we were on the air, and Eric said, I think Mike Pompeo just got confirmed as Secretary of State. And yet, who knew? I mean, it just got completely rolled over. Just your sense of this week for the White House.
I mean, every week, you know, we come here on Fridays and say there's never been a week like this in the presidency. And of course, every week we're saying that. So gosh, only knows what's going to happen next week. But look, this week was very significant. The loss of Ronny Jackson as potential VA secretary was huge. That's a major agency that is still unmanned at this point. The Pompeo replacing Rex Tillerson, who was also sort of systematically fired by the president, that's perhaps a move forward. There'll be some more activity there and hopefully some more diplomatic efforts out of that building. But it's every week is another crazy song and dance.
Every week is. Beth Fooey is senior politics editor for NBC and MSNBC. Thank you.
Thank you.
The future of one of the government's largest agencies is up in the air after White House Dr. Ronny Jackson withdrew his name from consideration this week to be the next VA secretary. Whoever leads the Department of Veterans Affairs next will have to deal with deep, some say systemic, problems at the VA, including controversy over how it handles reports of wrongdoing from its own employees. Last year, the Trump administration created a new office designed to shield whistleblowers from retaliation. The Office of Accountability and Whistleblower Protection has taken on dozens of new cases of alleged whistleblower retaliation. But some employees who are flagging fraud, waste, and abuse are skeptical. Dan Martin is one of them. He's chief of engineering services for the VA's Northern Indiana healthcare system. And Dan joins us now from Indianapolis. Dan, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also speaking with Tom Devine. He's legal director at the nonprofit Government Accountability Project, which is representing Dan Martin and other whistleblowers at the VA. Tom, welcome to you, too.
Thanks.
Dan, first of all, let's hear about your case. In 2016, you had reason to believe the Indiana VA was fraudulently awarding contracts for new water filtration systems at local VA hospitals. Tell us what you saw that made you blow the whistle.
Yes, sir. Well, I got to the Northern Indiana VA about August 2015. There were a lot of work that was awarded before I got there. So in one case, it was a water filtration system. As soon as I got the documents, the contract documents and the drawings, I was looking at it and it threw up a lot of red flags to me. Pretty much the biggest one was the fact that this water filtration system was a stainless steel tube with some grooves in it. It really had no filter qualities, had no properties to it. So we started digging, me and a couple other engineers, and we've asked a lot of questions about this. How did this happen? Why this shouldn't have even been awarded? It doesn't even marry up to the VA's, the government's contract, which said it was supposed to reduce scale, mitigate Legionella. It didn't seem it was impossible.
Waterborne diseases. Basically.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Which is a big factor in the VA.
And very important in hospitals, of course, to protect against that.
Oh, yes. It is seriously a problem with immune-compromised folks and can easily cause death.
Did you think this filtration system was close to worthless or what?
Yeah, pretty much. It was, I would say, a several hundred-pound paperweight.
Dan, at this point, the newest version of the VA Accountability Office had not been formed, but you did go to the Federal Office of the Inspector General. Tell us what happened next.
Well, I started digging around and finding a lot out. I struggled with it. It wasn't until April of 17 I was so conflicted and I knew what I was dealing with was wrong. And I contacted the inspector general through the OIG online hotline.
So, Dan, did the Office of Inspector General take your allegations seriously, and what happened?
Yes, sir, they did. They interviewed me. I told them a much longer version of what I've just spoke to you about. And at the end of about an hour and 20 minutes, he told me he already knew all that. The thing he couldn't figure out is this particular device, this filtration system, was going into a number of VAs in Indiana and Michigan.
Tell us, when you blew the whistle on this, what happened next? You still work for the VA in northern Indiana, but I understand you feel you've been retaliated against. They've gone after you. How so?
Yes, sir. Well, I had been cooperating with the OIG for some time, but in the case of the water filtration system, they'd already gone into four VAs between Indiana and Michigan. On the fifth one, in February of 2017, I was talking to VISN leadership, the regional leadership for the VA.
VISN is like a district in the VA, yeah.
Yes, sir. And one of the VISN leaders told me they caught this fifth one before it went in. Again, this was February of 2017. By March of 2017, I was accused of an altercation that never happened, and it was spun up. And ironically enough, because I am a service-connected veteran, I have TBIs and PTSD, they spun it up that I'm just a crazy veteran. And I think the term gaslighting would be pretty fair.
Tell us how this has affected your life and your career, Dan. How do you spend your days?
Well, for the past over a year now, I've sat in an office, and I sit there all day. I do nothing. I get no job assignments. Nobody talks to me. I'm isolated from everyone and everything.
You're isolated from everyone and everything, and you feel this is part of the retaliation?
Yes, sir. I mean, I'm not able to be promoted. They're blocking me from getting training. They're just making me inert.
Let's bring in your lawyer now, Tom Devine, with the Nonprofit Government Accountability Office. And Tom, in Washington, you've worked on whistleblower cases for decades. How typical is Dan's experience within the VA?
Dan's experience is typical of the VA, but it's much worse than the rest of the federal government. The VA is by far the most repressive federal agency in the government. Depending on the year, between a third and 40% of whistleblower retaliation complaints for the whole government comes from this one agency. The VA's first reaction to most whistleblowers, and he's actually done better than a lot of them with the inspector general working with him, is for the IG or other investigative agencies to investigate the whistleblower instead of the whistleblower's evidence and put them under criminal investigation and refer them for prosecution. The second thing is to isolate them, keep them away from the evidence, make them pariahs among their peers, make an example out of them. What happened to Dan is very typical. Basically, we call it like putting the whistleblowers in professional solitary confinement. And he actually understated it a little bit. Generally, the rooms where these people are assigned to bounce off the walls without duties are unheated in the winter and uncooled in the summer. It's like putting somebody in a hot box.
Tom, 40% of retaliation cases come from the VA? I mean, what's going on here? Is this a uniquely dysfunctional federal agency?
It's an agency that's more than a little bit backward. Its structure is very feudal, and there's very little that the national office actually can do to crack down on problems and abuses of power in the local areas. And we saw that in Dan's case, where the National Whistleblower Office that President Trump created, Office of Accountability and Whistleblower Protection, arranged to get him out of a job where they weren't using him for anything and bring him to a new office for a fresh start that needed his help and wanted him. And the Indiana office said, we're not going to let him go. We're going to keep paying him to shiver or sweat and not do anything to support the taxpayers or our agency mission.
So if this new whistleblower office couldn't help Dan, it raises fundamental questions about whether the agency can really police itself from within. What do you think?
I think that the agency needs a structural overhaul so that they have the capacity to impose accountability when the national leadership is acting as public servants. A lot of times they haven't. but sometimes they try. And I've been impressed that the new OAWP is actually making a good faith effort. But until they get some enforcement teeth, all they're going to be is background noise. And right now, the situation at the VA is by far the most intolerable in the government in terms of public service. And isn't that ironic? Because at other agencies, when there's fraud, waste, or abuse, maybe we have a budget overrun or something gets delayed. At the VA, when there's a mission breakdown, it has life and death consequences for America's veterans.
And Dan Martin, I want to come back to you. You say you've been sidelined professionally. What has the VA done, if anything, to address the problems you brought forward with the fraudulent contracts?
That's a great question. I haven't heard anything. I have said during this I've been isolated from getting my care. I have a degenerative arthritis, my TBIs. I've been paying out of
traumatic
pocket.
Traumatic brain injury.
Yes, sir, and paying out of pocket to see civilian doctors. But one thing I want to do be clear, VA is the best care in the world. I will say, except for this incident, the worst experience I've had at the VA before this was better than the best experience I've had at civilian doctors. I love the VA, and when I'm there, I feel like I'm wearing a uniform again and part of something special.
But, Dan, the same question I asked to Tom, do you think the VA, given your experience, can police itself when it comes to whistleblowers and this pattern of retaliation?
I'm hopeful. I do. I'm probably overly optimistic. But this isn't systematic everywhere. It's a group. It's an entrenched group that have been doing this a long time, and they're getting away with it. Nobody's held them accountable because they're the ones that actually hold the power. They can outwait until there's a new VA secretary. They can outwait administrations. They're constants, whereas politics is a variable.
That's Dan Martin, whistleblower and chief engineer for VA hospitals in northern Indiana. Dan, thanks for coming in.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
And Tom Devine is legal director at the Nonprofit Government Accountability Project. Tom, thanks to you as well.
Thanks for having us.
A few more things we want to add about this story. We've reached out to several VA offices for a response to Dan Martin's allegations that he was retaliated against for bringing attention to the contracts for the water filtration systems. A spokeswoman at the VA's Office of Accountability and Whistleblower Protection told us, quote, "We are not at the point in the investigation to comment." We've also confirmed that the Office of Special Counsel has reopened an investigation into some of Dan Martin's allegations. And a spokesman at the VA's Northern Indiana healthcare system, where Martin works, told us he could not comment on an ongoing investigation. We'll continue to follow this and other allegations of whistleblower retaliation. You're listening to Here and Now. Today, Port Aransas, Texas is kicking off its annual three-day Sand Fest. Past winners include sand sculptures of galloping horses, lounging gorillas, and a giant girl with flowing snake-like hair. The festival usually attracts thousands of visitors, but it almost didn't happen this year because Port Aransas, on a barrier island off the Texas coast, was hit hard by Hurricane Harvey last August. Joining us now is Mark Landrum. He's on the board of Texas Sand Fest. Hi, Mark. I hear you're at the beach. Pretty good conditions today for making sandcastles?
Oh, yes, it's great. It's sunny and going to be up to 78 degrees today, so it's perfect beach conditions.
Just a couple of weeks ago, many of the hotels in the port area were still closed following damage from Hurricane Harvey. Usually this time of year, hotels are, you know, almost sold out. Are they open now?
We're probably at about 40% now have a return. A lot of the large condos may take a year or may take 2 years. My place is fine, but I wake up every morning to the sound of roofs being put on and siding being put on, and it's like building a new town all at once.
So recovery is underway, but the town has a long way to go?
Yes. Town is very excited about Sandfest this year because it's the first event that didn't get canceled. So we're hoping to have a big crowd, a lot of people, and come down here and help us bounce back.
Mark, you've been a fixture at Sandfest for many years. Were you pretty worried that the festival wouldn't happen this year after the hurricane?
Yes, our first board meeting after the hurricane, we sat around and kind of looked at each other and said, how is it going to be possible to have the Sandfest this year? We got to talking about it and said, that'll be our goal. We'll pretend it didn't even happen, and we'll help some of these people out that need help, because we do raise money for the community and get SanFest going and give people a positive spin on the hurricane.
Mark, how dependent is Port Aransas on tourism?
It's our main industry. That's all we have really here is the tourists. And we do get tourists all summer long. And then in the wintertime, we get what we call winter Texans, people who spend their winters down here, get out of the cold up north.
Mark, hurricane season is coming soon, starting in June. Are you at all frustrated with the pace of recovery, or you think, given what happened, things are on track?
Well, I'm kind of like everybody else here in Port Aransas. We're all excited about how quickly things, after the hurricane, people chipped in and helped each other out. We didn't wait on anybody to come down here and help us out. We just jumped in and started recovering, picking up and cleaning up. And it didn't start slowing down until, you know, you started getting waiting on contractors, waiting on insurance. And it's discouraging when you see your favorite store is not open yet, or I still have friends that are sleeping in other towns, you know, close by, and coming over here and working on their house. They can't get in their house. You have pockets of that, you know, a little depression, but you bounce back when you realize something new opened up.
Well, we wish your town all the best in rebuilding and hope you guys have a happy SanFest.
Okay, thanks.
Mark Landrum is on the board of the Texas SanFest, which goes through this weekend in Port Aransas. He's also known as the Port Aransas Sandcastle Guy.
Yeah, clap your hands, stomp your feet, feel that rhythm, feel the beat tonight.
That's the band Two Tons of Steel. They'll be rocking SanFest this weekend. You are listening on this Friday to Here and Now.
Tens of thousands of school teachers across Arizona and Colorado continued their statewide walkouts today, protests that started yesterday and are part of several across the country recently calling for higher pay and more funding for school programs. For years, employees across the public sector, including teachers, have seen a decline in benefits and pay, which may be a part of the reason that public employee payrolls aren't growing or are growing at historic lows, and that could be eroding the middle class. For a look back at the government job, we're joined by Nathan Connolly. Hi, Nathan.
Hey, how are you?
Good. And Ed Ayers?
Hey, Robin.
Hi. They are historians, co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. So let's get right to it. And I have to tell you, in the mid-60s on Long Island, my school district, Plainview, was the first to have a district-wide teacher strike. I remember it so powerfully. We watched the movie Around the World in 80 Days, every single day for, I think, 10 days of the strike. So I can't wait to hear more about, you know, the history, I mean, how teachers fit into this. But take us back, the early days of the government job itself. What kind of work was it?
Well, it was decades after decades of pretty much blatant spoils system. You work for the guy who gets elected, you get a job. He gets unelected, you don't have a job.
Yeah.
And that goes on, you know, for over half a century.
Okay, so Ed, you've got us started. Nathan, how did it start to change?
Well, I mean, the sad thing is that at one level, you know, the Civil War becomes a great leveler, right? It creates an opportunity for the expansion of government employment, especially for African Americans. With Reconstruction in particular, a number of people of color begin to enter government employment in really important ways. And there begins to be some sense of at least standardization about requirements. But, you know, to Ed's point, you know, one variation of the spoil system really does come roaring back in the early part of the 20th century. You have the election of a president in Woodrow Wilson, who, at seeing the number of African Americans who are employed in the federal bureaucracy, basically helps to orchestrate a mass demotion of black workers. You have, you know, for instance, clerks who are making as much as $1,200 in a year, making $500, which is, you know, obviously a drop of over half of one's income. And this devastates a lot of the ascendant black middle class that really did rely on generations of government work.
Nathan, I got to ask you, how did he do that? I mean, you just say, oh, there's too many African Americans in the workforce, so we're going to cut the, I mean, how did that happen?
Well, I mean, it was pretty clear that government employment was important and it was a way into the middle class. The way that the demotion happened was actually over long weekends. It was happening by way of Very discreet verbal communications. Very little of it was written down. And it became one of those things that in Wilson's mind was about government efficiency, but was very much, even in his own circles, questioned morally. And there were a number of people who wrote letters to Washington, black and white, who opposed the segregation of the civil workforce because they recognized the importance of government work.
This was in 1913. So, Ed, they literally segregated the civil service jobs? I mean, higher pay for whites?
Yeah, so this becomes a violation of, you know, the major reform in all this, the Civil Service Act of 1881, 1882, following an assassination of a president. But when James Garfield is assassinated, then everybody agrees, yeah, this is out of control. We need to bring standardization of testing and so forth. So you might have thought, and then African-Americans actually flourished. But when you have Woodrow Wilson kind of coming in with a strong mandate from Southern Democrats, it seems an affront. This is the very same time that they are putting understanding clauses in constitutions and things like that to basically get their way around merit and right back to just bold racism.
So now we've got a segregated workforce, early 1900s. But talk about the entry of women into and the impact of women on government jobs.
Well, the main entry for most women would have been briefly teaching. Now, we think about government. We're not just about federal government. If you think about, you know, state and local government in particular, the largest number of government employees would have been female because, as their employer said quite explicitly, they work for a lot less. So as the profession became feminized, it also became marginalized and was vulnerable to things like employers pushing out individual women because they became pregnant or because they were seen out too late at night. And you'd found that the greatest amount of government employment was extraordinarily vulnerable.
Yeah. And Nathan, talk about the rise of the government job itself under FDR and the New Deal.
So the financial and economic collapse that came with the Great Depression obviously put a real premium on the government's ability to respond dramatically to the economic needs of all Americans. So you have Works Progress Administration, you have the Civilian Conservation Corps, a spate of government agencies that really do ride in to help Americans get back to work and try to get the economy going again. And this becomes important for a variety of reasons. Obviously, you have artists and you have architects and you have a number of unskilled and lower skilled workers who are all getting some broad support during this moment in time. There are ways in which, you know, African Americans who were initially excluded from certain kinds of civil employment are brought into the government once again in ways that was really almost a generation in the making. Many women who were working as teachers in marginal ways began to also see modest improvements in their overall standard of living. In fact, the ability of the federal government to respond to, you know, broad employment needs helped to, in many ways, radicalize American workers and begin to push them in ways to obviously seek more representation in labor unions, but also in the heart of segregation and discrimination to push for equal pay in places like schools. So the effort to really equalize education and equalized teacher pay begins in the South in 1940 as a direct response to a groundswell of, you know, understanding and activism from those who have protections under government work.
Yeah. Well, but when did the status of teachers change? When did it go from, oh, these are just nice women earning some pin money until they, you know, meet a husband, to something different?
So, I mean, I think it's really important to bear in mind that education, to Ed's point earlier, is a highly localized affair. And so there's a way in which teachers, even if they weren't paid, you know, high salaries, did have social standing in the communities. And so it's not uncommon to see teachers enjoying a high measure of status. And it really doesn't become an issue for the most part until you begin to see broader concerns about unionization that really do emerge in the 60s and 70s. And the teacher as a symbol in some ways begins to take on this reputation of being the kind of bloated public sector employee, right? So, so there's a very slow and gradual movement to think about the public sector as being a space of waste. And teachers, by and large, get wrapped up into that moment. But just really quickly, Robin, to be very clear, as these happenings are unfolding through the 50s and 60s, there are also ways in which people from a variety of sectors are trying to really encourage the government to even have a greater role in employment, asking for instance, a full employment bill or looking for an economic bill of rights to be realized. Even the March on Washington was about jobs and freedom, and it's very explicit about there being a massive public investment in a works program again in the 60s. And so it's teachers, it's public sector workers, it's activists who are really seeing the government as a necessary piece of a broader economic growth model.
Yeah, but Ed, where are we now? You have people in office who are devoted to downsizing government, but you have government workers pushing back, and you have teachers in Oklahoma. I mean, it's just obscene. You've got, I'm reading about Eldon Johnson. He's in the New York Times. Takes care of kids with cerebral palsy and autism at a group home, working from 2:45 to 10:45, earning $12.50 an hour, less than clerks at 7-Eleven, then goes to his better-paying second job at a private mental health center where he works till 8 a.m., and he's still not making it. What does that do to the middle class, and what does that matter?
Yeah, we've seen across the 20th century these things go in cycles. Different times, as Nathan is saying, there's a sense that there needs to be greater solidarity and mobilization. Mm-hmm. But since the 80s and, you know, No Child Left Behind and its successors, this idea that teacher autonomy needs to be brought under control, that, as you say, the amount of money spent needs to be lessened. So what you're seeing is that the calculus that a lot of the people who have been so intent on cutting budgets have made is that government jobs aren't real jobs. Mm-hmm. They are not subject to the same discipline of the marketplace, and they're not productive in a way. That's the pattern. The greater your devotion to providing care to other people in the United States, the lower your compensation. I think it's a larger kind of calculation of what counts as real work.
Right.
And somehow, strangely, taking care of other people doesn't seem to count.
Yeah. That's Ed Ayers with Nathan Connolly, historians, co-host of the weekly podcast Backstory, giving us the backstory of government workers. Nathan, Ed, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's auction season. Every spring, charities gather donors in ballrooms and event spaces across the country and auction off everything from fine art to yoga classes or maybe a weekend at a luxury resort. For many nonprofits, it's their most important fundraising event of the year. But for some artists who are asked to donate their work many times a year, it can be a burden laden with unintended consequences. Amy Costello, senior correspondent for the Nonprofit Quarterly, has our story.
Kara Ober has been supporting herself as a fine artist for 13 years. She is also founding editor of Be More Art, Baltimore's art and culture magazine. I asked her to guess how many times a year she's asked to donate her work to charity.
I would say at least 50 times a year.
Yes, that's right. 50 times a year.
Every kind of cause that you can imagine in Baltimore City, from city schools, from arts programming, to public health and different health issues. I mean, Baltimore is a city that has a lot of needs, and it has a really thriving arts community.
And of course, so do most other cities in America, which puts pressure on artists who live there. Brooklyn-based artist Ellen Harvey has exhibited her paintings, multimedia work, and installations worldwide. Over the years, she's had to pare down the number of charity auctions she gives to because it just wasn't financially sustainable to give away her work for free. Now, when Harvey does say yes, she makes a careful calculation.
You need things that aren't that, you know, are small enough, not too expensive, don't represent too much of your time, and yet are actually desirable in some way. You can't give people rubbish, obviously.
But artists get rubbish back, from Uncle Sam anyway. Artists can't claim tax deductions on their donations, no matter how much they sell for at auction. They may only write off the cost of materials. Sometimes a nonprofit will offer the artist a portion of the proceeds they receive from an artist donation. Often, they don't.
I believe that an artist should get 50% of all sales. That is the protocol in galleries in North America and Europe.
Matt Gleason owns the Coagula Curatorial Gallery in downtown L.A., and for 30 years he's been a freelance art critic with a reputation for not mincing his words. Gleason says artists should get their 50% of the sale, no matter whether they're selling at a high-end gallery or donating to a charity art auction. And nonprofits need to school themselves on protocol.
What's worse, that they don't understand the protocols of the art world, or that they do understand the protocols of the art world and they're trying to exploit the artist out of some sort of charitable guilt trip?
But plenty of fundraisers have no problem asking artists to donate all proceeds to the cause. Monet Silva has worked as a professional fundraiser for 17 years. She has never given a portion of the sale of any art back to the artist.
Ultimately, we are trying to raise money for the cause that we're working for. And so I think the more that we can raise, the better. So if we were constantly having to give back to the artist, it starts to cut into what we're actually trying to do there that night and the money that we're trying to raise.
Silva is executive director of JDRF New Mexico, a nonprofit for diabetes research. Her most recent auction raised nearly $500,000. And when a prominent artist donated a work, Silva left nothing to chance in order to ensure the piece would fetch a significant sum for the cause.
We really had to make sure that in our ballroom were sitting at least a few people that we knew were going to bid on that piece of art.
This is key. When a charity isn't as planful as Silva's, an artwork can go for cheap at auction, or worse, doesn't sell at all. That's embarrassing for the artist. The best nonprofits know how to avoid this. Silva always strives for what she calls a win-win for artist and charity. She does it by fostering long-term relationships with the artists and displays their work in the way they request. By getting the right buyers into the room, Silva hopes to dissuade the so-called bargain shoppers who rile gallerist Matt Gleason.
There are many savvy collectors who I only see when I go to charity art auctions.
Gleason says these kinds of buyers likely see no need to ever step into galleries like his.
What motivation do I have to go to a gallery and pay full price when I know that your well-meaning artist is donating work to charity art auctions that if I really scout and spend the time, I can get for cents on the dollar what the gallery would charge full price for?
This is actually a thing.
It can be a little strange later in life because then you run into people who say, I've been collecting your work for years. And you think, really? I never saw a penny of that.
Artist Ellen Harvey has donated to many charity auctions over the years.
What I think is that people, when they buy things at charitable auctions, don't always realize is that the artists aren't getting any money. They're not getting a tax break. They're not really getting anything. And some people don't think about how it sounds to the artist when you say, oh, I've been collecting you. And you think, well, sort of, yes.
Even so, Harvey says it's important not to see artists as victims in all of this. She says, like most people, artists derive a lot of pleasure from giving. She says it can be fun to make art for charity. They choose to take part. And so artists have a lot of agency, she says, even if that agency is often compromised and difficult and messy. For Here and Now, I'm Amy Costello.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Eric Westervelt. Jeremy Hobson is back Monday. Robin, thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Oh, Eric, it's a pleasure to have you here. And you know you only did it because I got you Red Sox tickets.
That's part of it.
I'm Robin Young, and you are welcome anytime. It's Here and Now.
Thank you.